Hey everybody, it's Godfrey here. If you are listening to any Split Zone Duo product, and it is between April 15th and April 19th, Monday, April 15th, Friday, April 19th, the year of our Lord 2024, stop what you're doing, hit pause. We need your money again. I want you to go support the 2024 Charity Bowl. All right. So the New American Pathways charity, some of you guys instantly know what I'm talking about. If you don't, just hang tight. I'm going to help you out. The New American Pathways charity. This is started by Every Day Should Be Saturday. So that's Spencer Hall and Holly Anderson, but I'm talking about our whole sort of extended universe that gets in on this. So if you're a Channel 6 fan, if you are a Shutdown Fullcast fan, Split Zone Duo, Vacation Bible School, I'm probably leaving somebody out. This is the time of year we sort of all come together and we give money to a really, really good cause. And we do it by being really, really spiteful, usually by incorporating wonderful college football scores into the dollar amounts that we donate. Great example, classic example. Remember when West Virginia scored 70 points against not yet really, you know, like national title caliber Clemson, but I don't want to take anything away from that wonderful moment in Dana Holgorsen. 70-33, you can make a $70.33 donation if you are a Mountaineer fan. You know, by all means, do whatever you want. Go through there, create a dollar figure that in somehow, way, shape, or form makes you feel good as a college football fan. If you want to give money and compete to elevate your school, so if you're a Texas A&M fan or you're a Southern Cal fan, a Vanderbilt fan, it doesn't matter. There's a drop down for your school. There's also small schools too, by the way. It's not just an FBS thing, guys. If you want to donate under Split Zone Duo, we just did that. Myself, Alex, and Richard, we threw $1,000 into the pot. We want you guys to do the same. Donate what you can. The way to find the link right now, if you're listening, visit any of our social feeds. You can go to Channel 6. You can go to Spencer's page. Every Day Should Be Saturday. Any stuff on any social media, there's going to be a link to New American Pathways. You can also visit their website, newamericanpathways.org. Find the splash page. I trust that you can do it. I'm not going to read out the crazy long URL here, okay? You can also donate via mobile. You can text Charity Bowl 24 to 91999 if it's after Monday, which if we did this right, it's after Monday. Okay, last thing, if you don't know, what is New American Pathways? They support refugee families that are resettled in America from the day that they arrive in our country. So as soon as they touch the airport until the day that they take their citizenship exams, this is a huge task. It involves a range of needs and skill sets. It's everything from locating and maintaining safe housing, getting children enrolled in local schools, job training, language classes, legal aid, after-school programs. This is a massive undertaking to ensure that people achieve the American dream that all of us probably take for granted because we're usually busy screaming at each other about college football on the internet. Just, you know, it's kind of a thing that we do. So, New American Pathways, you can find them on Facebook. You can find them on Instagram. Please go give money. Please. Last year's donation, I believe last year it says the initial tally here, I'm reading some notes that Holly sent over, combined with the matching corporate donations, $933,000. That's really close to a million. And I know Holly and I know her sort of, let's call it like a need to sort of expand the empire here, manifest destiny. Let's make that a million this year, okay? Also, if you love Michigan, you know all about this charity. Michigan always wins, it feels like. If you don't love Michigan, good opportunity here to, you know, donate them out of the top spot. I don't even have a Connor Stallions joke here. Just if you want to give money to preserve the Michigan dynasty or destroy it, you should be incentivized in the worst possible way to help one of the best charities possible. And is that not the purpose of college football internet? New American Pathways. New American Pathways. New American Pathways.
We're coming, and we ain't backing down.
We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, looking in the mirror.
Everybody, just do your job. Just stay there.
Hey, will you shut up?
I'm bitterly disappointed with the officiating today.
Guys being dudes.
And they run through our like through a tin horn, man.
Luca Evans is the USC beat writer for the Orange County Register. He's a young reporter who works the USC Trojans beat really hard, sometimes harder than powerful people at USC would prefer. Luca was the reporter whom Lincoln Riley, I believe, briefly banned from covering the program last year before he was rightfully restored to being able to cover the Trojans on site. But if you follow him for the rest of the year, you know that he's just a really good rising talent in our industry who covers the Trojans in a lot of detail and serves that fan base very, very well. Luca wrote a story in the Register on April 10th that was one of the best pieces of reporting I've ever come across on the state of name, image, and likeness collectives. I think a lot of us in the field cover this topic at a broad level, a generalist level, but Luca's story hones in on exactly how the NIL ecosystem is working at USC. In short, it could be better. Luca has on-the-record quotes from the father of a current player who says that coaches tabbed his son's earning potential at $75,000 when he committed, but he hasn't yet gotten anything from USC's collective House of Victory. Luca talks to other parents, granted anonymity, who shed more light on a clear disconnect where players commit to USC thinking they'll get X in collective payments, and they don't, with one parent saying, quote, "It's like a handshake, and when you handshake and it's Lincoln Riley on the other side and USC, you think to yourself, well, they got money, right? We're not going to get expletive. They're good for it." Right, you would think to yourself, oh, USC is good for it and you're going to get it, and then you're shocked when you don't. One player, according to Luca's reporting, showed up on campus and received a collective offer that was half of what USC's in-house staff had indicated it might be, and found that the money arrived on a less consistent and less predictable basis, so not on a set schedule, causing him to not be able to make rent on time at an apartment that his NIL earnings were meant to afford for him. There's a ton more in the story. It's at the Orange County Register, and it's just a really detailed look at the NIL operations around a blue blood program. And it's very fair, and it has the executive director of the collective on the record too. Some USC fans are mad about it because I guess they'd rather have a homer telling them how everything is great all the time, which is how you know the reporter is doing well. And it is a pleasure to have Luca, after that long windup, the reporter on this story, on the show. Luca, welcome. How are you enjoying April in Southern California?
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me. It's good time. The weather, pretty beautiful. Just trying to, you know, finish out spring football and see where the Big Ten takes us.
Luca, at first glance, USC should be an NIL power. It's a historic blue blood. It's a private school in a major city where a lot of athletes would love to build their careers. I just moved here. The weather is amazing. I get it. I get the allure of the place. And yet your story makes clear that USC has not had the smoothest or easiest time adapting to this new world of college sports. Why do you think that is?
I think there's a number of factors. I think it's important to note that, you know, this isn't an all or nothing, you know, thing in either direction. They've still certainly been able to, you know, draw some five-star talent and plenty of players in through the portal and what have you. But at the same time, you know, there may be kind of a disorganization factor that's existed in the past that, you know, it is maybe holding them back from that top echelon of, you know, some programs across the college football landscape that are operating at this, you know, really high level across NIL. And I think the biggest factor is that they have tried to adhere really kind of closely to NCAA rules around NIL and operate under that and not kind of dip their toe into, you know, the gray area, which is kind of how this, you know, the whole Tennessee injunction started with, you know, a collective making direct contact and what have you. USC has stayed far away from any of that. That is one factor. And I think the basis for a lot of that story I wrote was because there's this disconnect where the collective can't really get involved really right in terms of, you know, potential valuations or earning potential or this and that. I think the other factor is just that the, you know, their donor collective, House of Victory, this is just the first, you know, I think they just celebrated their, you know, 1 year anniversary this past Sunday. It was previously under a different name, Boulevard LLC. It's gone through a lot of different iterations. That particular version didn't end up holding up. 2022 was really kind of a rough year for NIL. So they haven't really had this kind of streamlined path to the top, and it's taken a lot of work kind of around campus for, firstly, donors to even know, okay, what are we supposed to do here? Who are we going to donate to. There are multiple kind of collectives, a couple that kind of operate more as agencies that, you know, attract marketing deals. So it's taken a little bit of time to kind of establish, and House of Victory is definitely in a better position right now. The question is, you know, does UFC kind of fully buy into the freedom of this Tennessee landscape? And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, Luca, one of the reasons why I was so interested in having you on is that when you talk to administrators or people who work for collectives, but let's take an athletic director specifically, for example, you get a lot of commentary about how it's important to have your NIL operations, your collective operations under one roof, and you want right. to have organization. And there are a few places that have, you know, multiple collectives, and I think most athletic directors, gun to their head, would say they would rather not have that. USC seems to have the most confusing NIL history possible anywhere. In still less than 3 years of this whole world even existing, there was something called Student Body Right, named after the famous play popularized at USC. I think the founder of that is no longer with us. You mentioned Boulevard, which I understand is no longer going under that name. I know there's something with Keyshawn Johnson called the Tommy Group. The collective that you report on is called House of Victory. Like, is that, you mentioned disorganization. Is that as much of a mess as it seems? Why is it like that at a place like USC?
I think there really have just been, you know, I think in a market like LA, there's been, you know, multiple kind of iterations of this sort of alumni base and you know, fans and what have you, trying to organize groups that will take advantage of the opportunities here. And at the same time, it's maybe made the kind of the landscape in general a little bit more convoluted than it needs to be. And I think, you know, that at times I can't, you know, attribute or source this or anything, but I'm sure that has kind of made it confusing for donors who don't really know much about the NIL landscape. And, you know, I think the new sort of athletic department under Jen Cohen, from what I've heard, has made it, tried to make it clear, like, okay, House of Victory, this is our donor collective. You know, this is what they can do. This is how they can operate. And then, you know, over here, there are a couple of collectives, you know, like you mentioned, Keyshawn Johnson, Tommy Group, which is more of a, they'll help kind of negotiate endorsement deals and that sort of thing for USC athletes. The other interesting thing is that House of Victory is a nonprofit, and that is separate and unique from a lot of other collectives across the landscape. And I don't know too much as far as the details of that, but it does, you know, they do operate differently when it comes to a collective like the Tommy Group or I believe the other group that's around currently is called the Conquest Collective. So when you just have so many and so many iterations of House of Victory, like, it does get complicated and confusing. And I think that also plays into, like, when you talk to parents about these things, there are some that are happy, but there are so many that you just get the sense that, like, they don't really know the full details of everything available to, you know, their sons when it comes from a USC standpoint, or the different organizations here and there. They don't know what, you know, House of Victory is different than this or this. And it's kind of a confusing landscape. And so I think, you know, I'm sure what House of Victory and what USC is hoping is that, you know, with kind of the more freedom across the NIL landscape right now, there's a little bit more clarity that they can try and establish. So it'd be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, you mentioned in the story that given the injunction in the Tennessee case from a few months back, that, you know, right now there's no NCAA enforcement really whatsoever of right. what are supposed to be the NIL rules or quote unquote guardrails. And it sounds like the executive director of the collective at USC is hoping that that can be used to cut down on sort of this disconnect or misunderstanding, or some might call it lying, but seriously just some. I don't know what it really is. Between players getting an idea that they'll get paid this, and then they get to campus and they actually are getting paid that, or not getting paid at all yet. Do you see it unfolding that way? Or do you think that USC might have any regrets about trying to live sort of on the straight and narrow, given that the rules have completely liberalized rather than gotten tighter?
It's a good question. I think there are a combination of factors that go into, you know, why some of these issues have existed. And I don't think that, you know, I don't think that playing it on the straight and narrow can, you know, is the certainly the sole reason why they have been in maybe a more difficult position at times. And there is, but I think some of that disconnect that you talk about, right, and that the article and the story mentions and that players mention, just from feedback to the story, I think this is something that you see at a lot of collectives across the country in general, and a lot of schools where, you know, there's more general kind of numbers or valuation thrown around, and then that's not actually what reality is. And so I do think that House of Victory is probably hoping to establish a little bit more clarity and get involved more in recruiting so that they can kind of put forth exactly in front of parents and recruits, you know, they can offer them a contract before they, you know, even officially come to USC and put a number in writing and put, you know, exact details of how the payment would look in writing, because that's something that's not even, that's another big factor is, you know, a lot of their payments come through sort of deliverables and the completion of events and what have you. It's not just, hey, here's a salary, here's a monthly salary. You might get some of that, but some players might get that, some players might not. So right. As you can see just from the convolution of even me explaining this, like there's a lot that sort of varies in their operation, it seems like. And just them having the ability, I think, to sit down with recruits might eliminate, you know, X months down the line when someone maybe doesn't get the playing time that they were looking for and, you know, thinks to themselves, hey, I could get a lot, you know, I could get more money if I were to head elsewhere in the portal. And, well, I haven't really known what's going on with the NIL situation in general and this and that. So I think that certainly could help the operation to establish a little bit more clarity up front, just from everything that, you know, I've heard and reported on, what have you.
Yeah, one of the interesting points about deliverables that I thought was that I thought about while reading your story is that I think a lot of the collectives have gotten smart and they've put in-person deliverables in these contracts, which is sort of a sleight of hand way to say if you transfer to another school, you're probably not going to show up to do this event that you have to show up to get paid. I know that's something that a number of collectives, I don't know USC specifically, have tried to work into their contracts over the last couple of years. And it's interesting if you are a recruit who maybe expects that it's just going to show up, and maybe mm-hmm. the coaches who are recruiting you lead you to believe that it's just going to show up and then it doesn't. But that's I guess that's how it always is in your first job. It never lines up to exactly what you think it's going to be like. Luca, do you think that being in Los Angeles is helpful or harmful to USC's efforts to actually run a collective business? Because you mentioned that, you know, they're taking sort of an agency-like approach and trying to actually make deals that make sense and presumably sell marketing rights for these athletes. I have gathered in my still less than a year in Los Angeles that it's a big city with a ton of opportunities, but that most people here do not care about USC football. I mean, many do, but most certainly don't. And I wonder how you think USC views it. As you know, is it an asset? If Lincoln Riley were given truth serum, would he say that it's an asset to be in this big city, or would he say that it's a problem to kind of be a smaller fish in such a big pond?
It's a really good question. Something I haven't thought fully into, but I think there is, like, people, you know, LA is the city of stars. People always say that. I think that's very applicable when you look at someone like, you know, like Caleb Williams, who, you know, I don't know what The Athletic reported. I think his income was from NIL or 10 million or whatever it was. But it, someone like that who comes in, you know, they're not worried about what House of Victory is offering in terms of a salary or this and that. Like, Caleb Williams can earn so much by virtue of being in the LA market and having that kind of exposure and having, you know, this social media build up and what have you, and, you know, gather all these endorsement deals in LA because of that. You hear a lot of these athletes kind of come into LA expecting, you know, that sort of same exposure. And I think it only, you have to reach a certain kind of level, I think, where you can actually have that, because otherwise, like you said, you know, the market is so saturated here that, you know, maybe companies aren't as interested in, you know, or as invested as you would be a bigger fish in a smaller pond. But you look at, you know, even just, I did a story a month ago on, you know, Julian Lewis, who's Georgia quarterback coming in, or is at least for now a USC commit in the class of 2025. And, you know, even his dad is just kind of viewing it the same way of, well, for us, you know, the collective really isn't as important as it is in kind of building out the roster. You know, for us, we're going to follow the Caleb path, and, you know, there'll be endorsements outside of House of Victory and this and that. So I think for some kids, like, that's where the LA market really has that appeal and allure, is like, you can really build up your profile if you're at a certain level. But, you know, for the rest of the kids on the roster, it's like, I don't know how much these endorsement deals might be there. And that really puts the focus on whatever House of Victory is, you know, offering or this and that. And that, yeah, that I'm sure can make it tough. So I think that's an interesting question. And I think for the most part, one of the main issues has really just been kind of the rallying the donor base, from what it seems like. I think House of Victory, I mean, at least from what Harris has said, seem to be in a better position, a more competitive position. They have certainly hit on a number of recruits, you know, along with their new kind of coaching staff in the last month or so. But it'll be interesting to kind of see if that sticks and see if those, you know, promises and valuations kind of stick in this new landscape.
The donor base is interesting too. There are a lot of rich people in Los Angeles and a lot of rich alums of USC. And you mentioned that House of Victory is a nonprofit. I guess the IRS will have the last word on whether that's ultimately okay, but for now they're a nonprofit and donations are tax deductible. Do you sense that, because this is so interesting to me, just like, you're a blue blood, you're a rich school, but how does that actually translate to NIL money, to collective money? Like, what's the profile of a USC donor right now? Like, do they have a few whale donors who are giving a lot of money and, like, you feel like have positioned them pretty strongly in this arena? Or have they had motivation issues in actually turning kind of this well-heeled alumni base into a football piggy bank?
I think for one, you know, there are programs like Oregon, you know, the Phil Knights of the world, who, you know, they can operate at a different level from anyone else. And USC, I think, just simply put, doesn't have someone at that level that can just, you know, they can just kind of count on to pour in, you know, money into this program and be relied upon. From my knowledge, there are, I think, certainly a couple you know, bigger sort of donors and what have you, right. You know, alumni.
But the biggest a few years ago, I know Wayne Hughes was the guy who gave, was known, the self-storage guy, was known for giving oodles of money to USC, but he died in 2021.
Right. And I think, I mean, you've seen House of Victory just go on public, you know, fundraising efforts to you know, campaigns to raise up to $250,000 or this and that. I know there's at least a lot of investment from, you know, alums, but I'm not sure that there are many powerful people in Los Angeles and what have you, and ultra wealthy people who have come through USC. And to me, just in terms of the growth, overall growth of the collective, it doesn't seem like they've maybe had those sort of big time mega donors that they can consistently kind of draw from the well, because, you know, even Harris was talking about like the need to go back and justify the collective spending with donors and this and that. So there's not the feeling that like, oh, they have this, you know, Phil Knight, or they have this kind of constant and steady, you know, revenue stream from one or two. But, you know, I'm sure there's enough. And I think one of one of Jen Cohen's, you know, new athletic director, instituted back in August, I'm sure that one of her main prerogatives and priorities across the past few months and moving forward is going to be continuing to kind of rally that donor base at USC and try and tap into a couple areas that haven't been tapped yet. The other factor here is that, you know, I think the Lincoln Riley regime and rebuild has generated a lot of interest, of course, and naturally, and Caleb Williams and this and that. But the other factor here is, like, you know, you look at them in the post-Caleb Williams era heading into the Big Ten, and, you know, if there's not immediate success and this and that, like, this program and this town is used to winning, and if that doesn't come, it certainly de-incentivizes the push to be able to ask for that kind of money. So that's another factor in this whole process.
I think that right now, to my understanding, what's considered to be an elite collective operation is that you can fund a football roster that's somewhere in the very low eight figures, like, you know, 10 mil and up. There's probably a few programs that I broadly understand to be in that area. You know, you mentioned Spencer Harris, the executive director of House of Victory, the USC Collective. I'm sure that you tried, and he talked about how their position is, quote, significant. You're a reporter, not a speculator, so I won't make you guess a number about how much money they have, unless you want to. But is your impression that they are – where are they on the continuum? Like, in terms of, we can buy anything? That doesn't sound that way. Or, like, we can buy a lot, but we're going to get outbid sometimes, or we're a big disappointment. I'm curious where you see their overall strength in this market right now, given the dynamics that we've just talked about.
So this is more of an, slightly informed speculation. But, you know, from again, talking with Harris and seeing where USC has been, I would guess in terms of available funds, somewhere in the middle, upper middle kind of tier of, you know, what have you. If you think about the biggest spenders, maybe a rung or two, you know, a couple rungs below that. I think there are some at the absolute top, you know, the Oregons and what have you, that I don't think USC is going to approach simply, you know, even with the growth of the collective. I just don't think that's going to happen. Harris seemed confident in talking to him and, you know, being clear enough that USC was positioned competitively with, you know, a lot of the programs that you see kind of consistently spending right now in the NIL space, you know, the Ohio States and what have you. So again, you know, I did ask those questions. And so I don't have, you know, a concrete number to go off of, but I mean, it'll be, I think the other interesting factor here is that under Riley, USC has consistently kind of tried to dip into SEC territory more in recruiting and into areas where you have those really elite big time NIL programs that can throw that kind of money at recruits. You know, they're dipping more into Texas, they're dipping more into Florida, dipping more into Georgia. And so if it's sustainable, ultimately, if they can be competitive, we will find out very soon. Because USC is increasingly moving further and further away from trying to just dominate California in recruiting and increasingly kind of trying to turn itself into, you know, a national power with that kind of reach again.
Luca, before I let you go, I do have to ask you about the USC 2024 football season. On our show, we operate under a pretense that Lincoln Riley will score points. So whether it's Miller Moss or Jaden Mayava from UNLV playing quarterback, I feel confident that they will score points. But USC is finally free of Alex Grinch. You cover this program every day. I have to ask you, will any defense be played this year? Any at all? Just a little bit as a treat.
There will certainly be defense played. Their staff that they brought in, Danton Lynn, Eric Henderson, with Doug Belk, with Matt Entz, is good and quality enough to turn something into respectability. I think it'll be interesting to see how all those pieces fit together, but you know, Eric Henderson is a guy who is clearly going to be a huge impact hire. I think Dan Lynn has a clear kind of vision for what he wants to do with their defense. They are operating from the whole sense that you get in just covering spring camp. They are operating at a different level than they did in the fall. That being said, there are a lot of question marks in terms of the personnel that they have defensively. You know, and when you talk about big time upgrades or this and that. So I do think this, it has the chance, certainly within a couple of years, to turn into one of the best, you know, Riley defenses that we have seen in college football. I don't know if it'll get there this year, but I would anticipate there is a good few shreds of defense from USC this year. I don't know if that amounts to the full plate, but you know, we'll see.
A dab of defense.
Yes. Yeah.
Luke Evans, thanks for coming on the show. I'll see you around town.
Thanks, Alex. Really appreciate having me.
That's Luca Evans. He's the USC beat writer for the Orange County Register. And there is no way that USC, I think, is the only place where this is happening. I think that reporting on collectives and how they work is pretty dicey because so much about them is shrouded in secrecy and so many recruiting outlets depend upon them for different types of information. Also, a good number of them even have business entanglements at this point with collectives. So the point is, this is a weird, sometimes shady ecosystem. We need more reporting like Luca's. Kudos to him for doing the work. Richard Johnson, my co-host, joins me now for the back half of this episode. Richard, how are you?
I'm well. You know, the funny thing you bring up about collectives, I don't know how much of it's shady versus how much of it's just outright, like, I don't want to use the word sunshine pumping because that's not all the way what I mean, but like, it's maybe it's just marketing. Maybe marketing is like the easiest way to say it, right? Like everything that happens pretty much between January 1 and Labor Day for your football team is in some way, shape, or form marketing. And I think when we get into the collective sphere, a lot of it's marketing, right? Because we've got to talk about how much, you know, money we have, how much infrastructure we have, how much infrastructure we need. If you're a Ryan Day saying we need $15 million or whatever it is to field a roster. So I think it's the word is probably marketing more than it's like sunshine pumping or PR or whatever.
No, I think you're exactly right. And it's why it's so refreshing and so valuable to get a report that like makes a collective angry, probably, you know, that like digs into the nitty gritty of how these organizations, which are still really new, are actually working. So I'm glad that we got a chance to A, read that story, and B, talk to the writer of that report. Richard, game time. You know, it's the middle of the offseason. Figured I'd hit you with a little trivia, a little game. Please name this player for me, Richard, this college football player from the last decade and change. He's a wide receiver. In 2012, he started his career at SMU. Played in 10 games, had 168 yards receiving. Sorry, played in 9 games that year. 2014 and 2015, he played at Bowling Green under one Dino Babers. In the latter of those years, he had over 1,000 yards receiving and 10 touchdowns. And then in 2016, he was the number 3 wide receiver for the Alabama Crimson Tide team that lost to Clemson in the national championship. Richard, can you name this college football player?
Win a national championship in 2016?
No.
Lost to Clemson.
Guy got buckets at Bowling Green. Played under June Jones at SMU in 2012, which was my freshman year of college.
Yeah, I'm out on
this. Do you know?
Sharks, I'm out.
Richard is out. Congratulations to the listeners who are screaming at their car radios right now, or the scrollers who are screaming at their phones right now. It's Garrick Dieter, the wide receiver who went from SMU to Bowling Green to Alabama over a sparkling 5-year college career. But he only played 4, because in those days you could only play 4. Thanks for playing, Richard. It was fun.
In that bygone era, you could only play 4. Here's also the funny thing. When you said Garrick Dieter, I thought Garrick Dieter was... I remember Garrick Dieter as a tight end, which is interesting.
Well, I understand why you could remember him that way.
Right. I'm not disagreeing with you. The answer is the answer. I'm just saying in my head, when you say Garrick Dieter, I'm like, oh, he played tight end for Alabama.
Yeah, he's a bit of a thicker guy for a wide receiver. Also, his name's Garrick. That's a tight end name. If we're being honest about it. A little bit of code switching there by me. Yeah, he's a white guy named Garrick. I mean, it's a tight end. So I fully understand why you would think that. Richard, the order of the week, the order of the back half of the month in college football is the transfer portal window, which opened up today. We are recording this on April 16th, runs through the end of April. There's an interesting state of things, and, you know, disclaimer goes here about how fast news can move during portal windows. And so I'm not going to get hung up on things that are likely to change 5 minutes from now. But I'm interested in the entire enterprise of this portal window, because on the one hand, we know from the past that springtime with transfers and the spring portal window, which is still a relatively new thing, is not the boom time for transfers. You know, you get guys who are dissatisfied with their situations after spring ball and might be looking for more playing time. You get guys who are, you know, dissatisfied with their situations for any number of reasons who might decide to leave now. But I think most players who are in that situation who want to roll out kind of know after the previous season. And so they leave in the winter when the portal window is open after the season. And fewer players historically do that during spring ball. I imagine that's going to be the case again this year. But on the other hand, I think there's a lot happening right now. The NCAA is taking legal setback after legal setback. So 2-time transfers currently, for the moment, can move around without punishment, without having to sit out a year. That might change, but the NCAA has not shown an indication that it's going to start to enforce that old rule at the current time. So right now, I think as a status quo, you've got 2-time transfers with immediate eligibility. That probably stacks what's in the portal. You currently have no enforcement mechanism at all for the NCAA to do anything about schools and collectives collaborating directly to rather explicitly bid on talent. and that's going to probably juice the portal. And you also have the coaching carousel shaking out the way that it did. You had Alabama and Michigan both opening very late after the portal window had closed for those teams to add players at the end of the season. You had Washington opening in turn. That's two blue bloods and another national champion aspirant that are going to need players probably if they want to not have a pretty severe step back year in their first year under their new coaches. And you have these collectives that have been fundraising like political parties. You mentioned like since January 1st, literally Alabama was fundraising for their collective from the luxury suites at the Rose Bowl. Like, we're falling behind. Look, we just lost this game. You have to donate. That's a lot of factors, Richard, that would scream to me that this is going to be a really intense time these next couple of weeks in the transfer portal. And it doesn't happen all at once because spring practices don't end at the same time for every program. Some of them, a bunch of them, still have spring practices going on as we record this on the 16th. I saw that Max Olson from The Athletic reported that just as of about 11 a.m. Eastern time on the first morning, there were more than 90 scholarship players in the portal, which was well ahead of the first day last year, just in the morning. What do you think these few weeks are going to bring in college football?
I think I struggle because I don't want to use the word chaos, because I don't want to call every time of tumult in college football chaos because we're living in it at the current moment. I will say, I think December was chaos. I think in this portal window, the big names, and I do think there will be a few big names that come in. I think the big names that come in this portal window are going to have sort of outsized influence on what we think about this portal window, because everybody, so to speak, is not going in right now. Everybody, in scare quotes, went in December. You know, this is an April portal that things go a little bit different. I know, you know, a big name, I think Penn State's Keandre Lambert Smith, looks like he may be going in the portal. He's been away from Penn State's team for a week or so. So it looks like he's going to go in. I'm not sure if he's in yet as of Tuesday, April 16th. Yeah. He is. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a name, right? There are going to be a couple names, and I think they're going to stand out because of that. I do think it's funny, the guy who arrived in January and is now transferring again in April, that's that is something, man. That is really, really something. It's good for the young man. It's just something. I don't know, man.
I'm not going to fully mea culpa this because I think the conversation requires some nuance. I fully support no sit out rules for transfers. I think that players should be allowed freedom of movement in the same way that coaches have freedom of movement. And I don't think that the restrictions that have existed in the past were designed to do much more than control these players and give schools power in a dynamic that exists between them. But, I think it's an important but. I think there is something to it that if you're transferring in January and then again in April, it's not great. Like, it's not great for your development, most likely. I don't like how boomerish it sounds, but like, there is something to trying to promote a little bit of continuity in these athletes, in these young men that, you know, might be being lost. I think I can acknowledge that. And you should be allowed to do that. Absolutely. There should not be an ability for the schools to prevent you from doing it. But I think in terms of the guys giving advice to these players, I don't love the way that it unfolds with some of these guys where you uproot your life in January while you're still a college student and you uproot it again in April. I don't like it. I don't think it doesn't seem good for anyone's development.
And by the way, you know, for those of you who don't know like how the portal like functionally actually works, you can go in and you like, first of all, when you tell your compliance person that you want to go in, you tell your head coach that you want to go in, you sort of have, or the compliance department has 48 hours to put you in, literally put you in. And if you've never seen the portal, like it's literally just an online, it looks like an online Excel sheet. And you scroll down or whatever, and then you click on somebody's name. And sometimes it has a do not contact tag, right? Chris Hummer of 247 reported that Caden Proctor Alabama's offensive tackle, who was then Iowa's offensive tackle and is now pretty much going to become Alabama's offensive tackle again, goes in with a do not contact tag. So some people have a do not contact tag where it literally says, you can't call me. You're not supposed to call me. My email and my phone number are not going to be in my little portal when you click on my name in the transfer portal. So 2 and 2 equals 4, by the way, when guys go in with a do not contact tag. That means they've got an inkling about where they're going, and it means they had an inkling on where they were going before they went in. So funny how that works in a lot of different cases.
The Caden Proctor situation is really interesting because it's like Alabama and Iowa played a two-way game of takesies backsies with this player. Caden Proctor was at Alabama last year, and then when he transferred to Iowa initially, he talked about how Iowa coaches had stayed in contact with him, encouraged him over the course of the season. Then he goes to Iowa after Nick Saban leaves.
He's from Iowa, by the way. He's from Iowa. And he wasn't just at Alabama. He played in like every game for Alabama last season.
Yeah. He was, I believe, their starting right tackle. Might have been left. It was starting tackle for Alabama. Yes. And now he goes back to Alabama with a do not contact label in the portal, presumably Alabama or forces associated with Alabama were talking to him when he was an Iowa player. But I mean, fair is fair, right? There's no honor in the transfer portal. Why should there be?
You know, a lot of what it is, and it's funny, it's Alabama's players. It's the players, which is the unforeseen force that in these kind of portal sagas, you can't really, I don't want to use a prosecute, but you can't really go after the players. But a lot of like, what I'd heard is like, oh, his boys were just like, oh, you really like, I think he went to Tuscaloosa for a weekend or something like that, and like was hanging out with his teammates, former teammates, and all that sort of stuff. A lot of the time, coaches will sort of deputize their players to recruit, as happens in high school recruiting, to stay in touch, to say what's up, to sometimes talk a little shit, you know what I mean? And it's kind of funny how that ends up working and may have been working in Alabama's favor in this case.
Richard, I'm interested in a handful of team-specific portal situations over the course of this spring as well. You mentioned the one that is maybe at the top of my mind, or one of the handful, is Penn State and their wide receiver situation. They have problems at that position. It was clear last year that they had problems at that position. It wasn't good for them. Drew Aller wasn't good and needed someone to make a play for him. Neither thing really happened. And now the only wideout that he had a consistent connection with to any success, Keandre Lambert-Smith, is heading out of town. They have added Julian Fleming from Ohio State, who is from the area and is in that receiver room now. But this is kind of a DEFCON situation for Penn State, isn't it? Like, this is a 12-team playoff program, the exact type of program that should benefit the most from the playoff going to 12 this year. And, like, a lot of losses on defense. There are going to be a number of guys who are about to have their names called in the NFL draft from that defense last year. Manny Diaz gone, the defensive coordinator, is the head coach at Duke. And now, I mean, you still have the tremendous running back room that they have. Your biggest problem on offense seems exacerbated. Penn State gonna do anything about this?
Me and you might disagree on what Penn State's biggest problem is on offense at the current moment. Because
you think it could be quarterback, but a passing game though. But passing game. Right. Passing game.
Right. Okay. And, yeah. Because that's where I want to go. Because we don't put any stock in spring game stats, but we do put some stock in a really poor spring game performance. And that was bad from Drew Aller.
I'm shaking my head, but go ahead.
If you go in there and you look at some of the highlights, lowlights, whatever you want to call it, it was not very good from Drew Aller. And for me, he's not a freshman walking in. It's multiple years in that offense. It's a spring game. Like, some of these are layups you need to be hitting. And I don't, it doesn't mean they're going to fall off a cliff. It doesn't mean he's going to fall off a cliff, but there was a lot of stuff you didn't see from Drew Aller last season that you thought you were going to. And if a trend continues that he doesn't have it, you could put Julio Jones out there at X. Like, what are we talking about?
I understand your perspective. I have a hard time even crediting a spring game performance as a confirmation data point, but fine. It was ugly, and I respect if you feel that way, because I know you're not doing it out of haste. Penn State addressing their passing game in some form or another, and I don't think it's going to be with a quarterback competition, seems important for them. Also in that, you know, same neck of the Big Ten, the Michigan quarterback situation is interesting to me over the course of this spring. The situation kind of speaks for itself. J.J. McCarthy, national championship winning quarterback, he's going to hear his name called very early. Alex Orji was the backup last year. And while people, including me, have gotten into arguments about the trust factor for Michigan with J.J. throwing the ball down the field, no one is arguing that Michigan did not want Alex Orji to throw the ball, because he didn't when he came in for specific packages. Jack Tuttle is going for a seventh college football season. He's in this room. There's a few other guys there.
Incredible.
This is a fascinating one to me, Richard, because like, you got a national championship program that pretty clearly has a quarterback vacuum. But there's not a ton of frontline options probably available this time of year, unless you dangle quite a bit of money. What do you make of the Michigan quarterback and Michigan portal situation going into Sharon Moore's first year?
I think that going into Moore's first year is what makes me the most uncertain about it. Besides the players, like, you could say what you want about Jim. There was a level, I think, of baseline competency that I expected with Jim Harbaugh as the head coach of a program and whoever he stuck out there at quarterback to an extent. I don't know what that looks like with a Sharon Moore-led Michigan regime, because I ain't seen it yet. Seen a lot of it on offense with the run game. I know what that's going to look like. They're going to figure that one out. And that will probably help any quarterback who plays for Michigan this fall, because obviously a strong running game is a quarterback's best friend in a lot of ways. So I don't know. But my opinion is more on an uncertainty about the coaching staff than what I think about the players in that room.
Honestly, the new Big Ten in general, Richard, I think is just I'm very portal curious about this conference right now. Washington, it's hard to pick a position group, but they need a ton. Will Rogers is in from Mississippi State. He needs guys to throw the ball to. They have extensive losses basically all over their national runner-up roster. USC, same deal. I think the most, we've talked about this a lot. I have no question that whether Miller Moss is the quarterback or Jaden Mayava from UNLV is the quarterback, that Lincoln is going to score points. But everything comes down to what this transformation on defense looks like. Just talked about it a bit with Luka Evans. Bear Alexander is staying around, the excellent defensive tackle. There had been some reporting that he was going to leave. He's not. But they need beef. They need more beef. They have two new defensive minds in DeAnton Lynn and Matt Entz coaching that defense. They need to get themselves some chess pieces. They brought in a tackle from A&M, Isaiah Rakes, who came in the winter and, like we talked about, has already portaled. He's leaving. Like, USC, where's the beef? Where are the guys who are going to tackle guys and get off blocks?
Of note, new defensive line coach Eric Henderson as well came over from the Rams, was Aaron Donald's defensive line coach, and was actually instrumental in bringing Aaron Donald back that year everybody thought he was going to retire, and they actually didn't. So that's going to be big, I think, for them on the defensive line as well. You are correct. I totally agree with what you said there. Like, got to get better up front. Hopefully Bear Alexander gives you enough. I don't think Bear Alexander was bad last year, by the way. I think he gave them pretty much what he needed. Maybe he wasn't a game breaker, but he gave them pretty much what they needed at that position. But yes, depth is going to be key, especially when you go into the Big Ten, or as you go into the Big Ten.
In the ACC, Miami is an interesting portal program for me over the course of this spring. They went and they got Cam Ward. That cost them a lot of money. I think that patience cannot be high forever and ever, even though I get the sense that the people there who need to be behind him are still very much behind Mario Cristobal. Nothing lasts forever. Cam Ward needs people to hand the ball to, throw the ball to. I think that a lot of people have understandable reservations about where the Mario project has gone in the first 2 years. It has not been good enough. And they have the quarterback and they need the skill guys. And Miami has kind of run a little bit dry. They were on like a dominant run of running back recruiting for a lot of years there and has run a bit dry at that position. I'm interested to see if they address that, if they address wide receiver. Richard, where are you on your Miami feeling thermometer right now?
Man, I don't know. Like, I don't really know what to make of it. You know, like I know Cam Ward can play, so I am excited to see that. I don't know. I thought pretty highly of the defense last year, especially in the secondary. And so I don't know. My Miami opinion, is not 100% fully formed at this point in time. And, you know, they're the other side of the coin in that week one game against Florida that is going to come in with, I don't want to do an anxiety bowl Godfrey bit, but like, you know, well, both of those teams need that game. And I think we all understand why.
Also in the Atlantic Coast Conference, North Carolina, the need here is defensive. The need at North Carolina is always defensive. Legend Cavazos, good cornerback who had come to them via Ohio State, has hit the portal. He was looking like he was going to be one of the handful of good players on that defense next year. Gene Chizik is out. Jeff Collins is in to run this defense. It is pretty clear that the guys on that roster as it exists defensively are unlikely to get it done unless Jeff Collins has like a Jeff Collins defensive coordinator masterclass, which he was pretty good at that job before things went a little bit left for him as a head coach. And on the other side of the ball, you're replacing Drake May with Max Johnson. My thought about Chapel Hill this year is that it could get very, very ugly unless reinforcements are brought relatively soon.
Reinforcements. They also have, another quarterback who is of intrigue. Is it Connor Harrell, I think? So, you know, pay attention to that. I don't know if they're going to have a proper QB competition. I have no idea. This is Max Johnson's third school, if I'm correct. Yes? Because he's a grad transfer.
Yeah, Max Johnson has done LSU, A&M, and North Carolina. Correct?
Yeah. So that's what a journey.
That Johnson family, there's the tight end brother. There's Brad, the quarterback. A lot of these Johnsons, like these Johnsons specifically in college football, tons of them.
We're all related.
True. I mean, from somewhere way back, you guys definitely have common relatives. The group of five school that I want to throw in here as a sweetener is Miami of Ohio. Richard, G5 portal conversations are very bleak and frankly a lot less fun to have than ones at the Power Four, because the general way of the world for a good G5 program is that you're going to lose more than you're going to gain in the portal unless you can be really savvy about bringing guys up from FCS or the lower G5. Miami won the MAC last year, and I was kind of just looking through a bunch of rosters to try to get a read on who took it the worst on the chin in the portal window after the season. And I'm pretty much settled that it's Miami of Ohio, which lost three of maybe like the five or six or seven best players on their team. They had a 10-sack edge defender, Caden Woolard. He's at Oklahoma now. Their starting running back and a very good one, Rashad Amos, is at Mississippi State now. Their leading wide receiver, Gage Larvadane, who we talked about last year, very fast. He's at South Carolina now. I think that they are the saddest G5 roster raid tale of the offseason. But, and the note of optimism that makes me interested in if they do anything over these couple of weeks and months going into the season, is that they also have Brett Gabbert coming back for a sixth season of college football. He got hurt again at the end of last year, the quarterback. Speaking of families that are in college football for a long time, how about the Gabberts? They hung on to him. They hung on to the MAC Defensive Player of the Year, a linebacker, Matt Salopek. And they have, in general, not huge losses. They only have a handful of guys. They just happen to be really good players who left this MAC championship team. I am interested in what Chuck Martin and the Redhawks might try to do over these couple of weeks to maybe, who knows, build a little continuity in the MAC. That's hard. Doesn't really happen a lot these days. Typically, the MAC winner in any given year is kind of a roll of the dice, unless it's Toledo. Going into the season, Miami of Ohio will be the G5 team that I might be rooting for the hardest in a, you guys can do it, you're fighting against gravity, and I respect you for trying to do that way. So shout out to the Redhawks.
That also is where you could get some unfortunate surprises in the April window, right? And I'm not being trying to be like cryptic or say that Matt Solopek is transferring or whatever, but I'm saying like it, the random, oh, you know, we need something as a P4 program. You know, we realize we're thin here. We realize, or somebody got hurt, or we realize we don't have it at this position, or this freshman we thought was going to step up in spring hasn't, or yada, yada, yada. That's when those teams can really go shopping and fill a need at the lower level that comes out of nowhere and then leaves you as a G5 program absolutely scrambling.
It's a tough deal. If you're a fan of a power program that splashes a lot of cash, you might find this April window to be a ton of fun, or at least like intriguing, something that you enjoy keeping track of because your team is a buyer. And if you are a G5 conference champion, it is likely to be a much harder few weeks. But hey, all the best to the G5 collectives out there and the G5 assistant coaches who are going to be working very hard to hang on to players over the course of these few weeks. I hope you can do it and do it in a financially equitable fashion. Richard, podcast business time. The promo code is the same at HomeFieldSCD20 for 20% off your first order. You know HomeField, you love them. They are the makers of the finest officially licensed vintage collegiate apparel in all of the land. Tees, hoodies, crewnecks, some call them nooties even because they have no hoods, joggers, hats, even jerseys and shooting shirts. What does HomeField not do? Very little, but I will tell you something else that they do do. They do send $150 gift cards to the two winners of the Split Zone Duo subscriber men's and women's bracket competitions. Jonathan in the men's bracket was in the 99.6th percentile nationally of ESPN brackets. And Richard, in the women's competition, our subscriber Tara was in the 99.9th percentile nationally, which I have never even been in proximity to before. Tara went 27 of 32 in the first round, had 15 of the 16 Sweet 16 teams correct, had the exact national title game matchup and outcome, was nearly perfect. It's just stunning to see. Jonathan and Tara, you will be getting emails. Congratulations to you, and thank you to HomeField for sponsoring this extremely fun and highly competitive, even more competitive than I thought, Split Zone Duo bracket competition this year. Also, Nokian Tires is a proud supporter of this show, and I'm a proud driver of a car with their tires on it. Bad tires are a great way to ruin the performance of your car and the safety of the people in it. Nokian tests its tires doggedly as far north as north of the Arctic Circle, and I will tell you, they work great for me in Southern California as well. Thank you so very much to Nokian Tires for your partnership with this podcast. And Richard, the last note is that at splitzoneduo.com, the home for this podcast on Substack, we now offer an all-in-one podcast feed with free and paid shows in the same place. It was the biggest annoyance with our entire offering for a long time was that if you subscribe to support this show, you had to download, you had to carry on your phone a feed for the paid episodes, a free feed for the free episodes as well. You do not have to do that anymore. If you're an existing subscriber, you want to look for the all-in-one feed that probably is already on your phone. If you previously set up a feed, it has everything in it. And if you are listening on the regular Split Zone Duo feed, you may notice that you are getting free previews of our subscriber episodes. We would, of course, love for you to check those out. And if you like what you hear, come and support the show at splitzoneduo.com. You get a lot of bonus episodes, you get newsletters, you get Q&A opportunities, and you get to be part of a very good college football community. All that at splitzoneduo.com. Richard, there's just a bit of other news this week. The former USC running back, O.J. Simpson, died of cancer. O.J. is, of course, most famous for winning the Heisman Trophy at USC and having his number, his retired number 32, still displayed prominently at the Coliseum in Los Angeles, unlike Reggie Bush.
You sure that's what O.J. Simpson's most famous for?
That's what I hear. There's a lot of fuss over his retired number still being out at USC. But no, in all seriousness, I wanted to make note of the ways that different college football institutions talked about O.J. Simpson dying, I think USC pretty much just piped down, right?
I think that, yeah. I think USC read the room pretty exquisitely. Well done to the Trojans and Trojan brass and Trojan PR that were like, we're going to sit this one out. You guys know.
Smart. The Heisman Trust could not resist and had to weigh in with a general note of condolence, which is fine. Like, I guess in a way, there was nothing in the statement that was just a note of condolence to the family that is that objectionable on its face. But I am just so interested by Heisman brain, how like OJ gets an acknowledgement, but amateurism crimes still get you like totally persona non grata'd, like in the case of another USC running back. It's bizarre, man, like the way that college football honorifics work and what compels certain institutions to talk a certain way and what doesn't.
Yeah, the OJ college thing is interesting, by the way, because he did not, a lot of people don't realize this, he did not start at USC. And he almost, I think there's like a butterfly effect where he would have gone to the military, and he doesn't go to the military. And then he goes to a JUCO and then almost goes to another, like other schools in the Southern California. Jesus, sorry. Almost went to Utah, I think, almost went to a couple other schools in Southern California and that adjacent area of the country. And then obviously ends up at USC as a two-sport athlete, and you know, the rest is history there.
Yeah, and if you go to a USC game today, they do still have the 32 kind of in the drapery with the other Heisman winners from USC. And it's just a bit of heavy-handed writing by the script writers that Reggie Bush is also a running back at USC. And you see what causes you to have honor stripped from you in college sports and what technically does not.
OJ was almost a two-time Heisman winner, by the way. He finished second as a junior to a quarterback at UCLA, funny enough. And he like came very close to winning that award. I have the Heisman votes pulled up. He basically lost the award in the way that Heisman voting works because Gary Beeman, who won it for UCLA, had more first-place votes than him, and it kind of flip-flopped. If OJ would have had more first place votes and he had second place votes, he would have won the award just based on how the point system goes. And so you've got OJ, a guy who won, who was a top two winner in the Heisman. And I think in a very weird way for the Heisman, is a banner carrier of the Heisman because of what he ended up doing in the NFL, right? So many players have great college careers and then do nothing in the NFL after they win the Heisman. It's not a good or a bad thing. It just kind of is what is. And then OJ Simpson for a long time was like basically one of the best running backs that had ever played. I mean, still is one of the best running backs who has ever played the game. And so I think the Heisman weirdly gets into a rock and a hard place there because he and his win when he did win it was so dominant. Like I don't think we have any unanimous Heisman winners but like OJ is pretty close. If you go look at the vote breakdown in 1968, when he ends up winning it. So I think there's a lot at play there with OJ and the Heisman Trophy Trust and USC and how that works. But, and then, you know, the thing they actually got him for was trying to go steal his Heisman back. You know,
To steal memorabilia. I believe his Heisman is actually at Heritage Hall, but it was to steal memorabilia. Yeah. No, you make a really good point about where he sits at the confluence of different organizations. There are only a few guys who are both Heisman winners and in the Hall of Fame, the Pro Football Hall of Fame. It's OJ, it's Roger Staubach, it's Paul Hornung, it's Doak Walker, it's Earl Campbell, Tony Dorsett, Marcus Allen, Barry Sanders, Tim Brown, and Charles Woodson. And so you just get like a lot of organizations that feel kind of like he's an important part of what they do. I think the Pro Football Hall of Fame also put out a statement, and it did not obviously mention the fact that he more than likely murdered two people in cold blood. The Pro Football Hall of Fame statement weirdly mentions, quote, his second career in acting and broadcasting, end quote, which, like, that is super bizarre. Like, if you're going to talk about anything other than he's in our building because he was a great football player, and then not mention that little chestnut about the double murder, that's even weirder than the Heisman, in my opinion.
I pretty totally disagree with that. I don't know if there's a way to expect the Pro Football Hall of Fame to quickly, like, summarize what that whole thing was in two sentences in a statement after he died. I don't know.
I think there is a lesson in this, and that is when you are a football organization that takes itself very seriously, whether you are the Heisman Trust, or you are the Pro Football Hall of Fame, or you are the USC Trojans, it is not great for your crisis communications department or your PR people if one of the most famous people involved with what you do is O.J. Simpson.
No, I would agree. And I also note this, Alex, of the interesting subplots in this whole thing, it sounds like OJ is going to be cremated. So I know, and I was having a conversation with somebody who was saying that OJ's brain would actually be a very interesting one to study posthumously because of all the things that we know about NFL players and brain injuries, and especially how NFL players were essentially lied to for decades about concussion risk and all that sort of stuff. And it doesn't sound like that's going to happen, because it does sound like OJ is going to be cremated. So there's a ton just going on here. And I don't want to say I didn't realize how famous and how deep the OJ things goes at a lot of levels, because obviously I did. But like, OJ, I think in the last 5 or 6 years had sort of, you know, it's his Twitter videos, right? Like it's you kind of fade into, I don't want to say cuddly grandpa, because that's really not what I mean. But I think the edges soften on somebody, on anybody, as they get into older age. And the way, just the ebbs and flows of this guy's life, the stuff that has happened in this guy's life, just crazy. I mean, you can make a 10-hour ESPN 30 for 30 about it.
The Pro Football Hall of Fame also lowered the flag to half staff. That's weird. That's the end of the show.
You're kidding me.
That's weird. Pro football, even weirder than college sometimes. Even weirder than college.